understand eventuate, and I know you folks don't either. But it means something other than fragmentation and creation, which still results in the appearance of a being. Is a word symbol designating all personalizations of deity. Therefore, the word symbol deity is larger than the word symbol God. Symbol deity can include the Father's relationship to paradise. He is not Father of paradise, because paradise is not a son. Word symbol deity can also include the Father's relationship to the eternal Son. But if we use the word God, we are probably excluding God's relationship to paradise. And we are emphasizing the personal relationship of the Father to the Son, and with the Son, to the Spirit, and to all other personal beings. They point out that as they use the word God, it can mean different things in these papers. And they say, when you're in doubt, it's God the Father. But we may specify some other aspect of God, and they take inventory of how they use the word God. God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, God the Supreme, God the Sevenfold, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute. See what they say about God the Supreme here. The evolving God of time and space is putting together everything that's going on in time and space, which is experiential. He is synthesizing creature-creator identity. That's so strange and foreign. No, it's exactly what Jesus did down here. He synthesized creature-creator identity. Came here a divine son. In the course of his 30-odd years, he found out exactly what it was like to be a human being. He was born, he lived, he died. And that human nature is an eternal part of his divine nature. Jesus of Nazareth, Joshua ben Joseph, the carpenter, lives in the Creator Son. Oh, just think of that as taking place throughout the whole grand universe. The whole thing adds together in the Supreme Being, expressive of the deity of the Supreme. God the Supreme, to me, emphasizes his spirit personality and stands in contrast to the Almighty Supreme, which is his synthesizing experiential power, which is unifying with God the Supreme. To me, the term Supreme Being is the larger of the other two terms. But you won't find the papers strictly adhere to that. They many times do. But they may refer to God the Supreme in the overall sense, as they refer to the Universal Father in the overall sense, where technically they maybe should use the term First Source and Center. I think of the Father in relation to paradise. It's a loose use of the term. Number five, God the Sevenfold is the evolutional aspect of deity. This is the adjustment which deity makes to the conditions as they obtain. In this universe age, we deal with God the Sevenfold. The last half of this paper emphasizes the personality and the spirit nature of the Father. C. second paper continues the story. It discusses his infinity and his perfection, his justice and righteousness, and concludes with a discussion of mercy, love, goodness, truth, and beauty. Always throughout these papers, whenever they encounter the problem of justice versus mercy, they point out that this is a love-dominated universe. Sure, God is a judge, but they say God as a father transcends God as a judge. When they're talking about the adjudication of mortal survival, they say in case of doubt, we always rule in favor of the creature. They say we would cheerfully risk another Lucifer rebellion rather than to err against mercy. They say we don't claim to administer justice in flawless perfection, but we do claim to administer it in mercy. When they get into the attributes of God, they don't really discuss his absolute attributes, do they? Yes.
I wondered if that is a concession.
Absolute attributes of God, they are the ultimate attributes of God. His omnipotence, his omniscience, his omnipresence. That's the middle floor in the firehouse. I don't think God's absolute attributes are discussable in finite language. We know they're there. The discussion of the inevitabilities. Over on page 52. I think is the finest analysis of the difference between a Havona native and an ascendant finaliter. Especially the third paragraph, where they choose such words as Havoners are brave but not courageous, kind but hardly altruistic in the human way, expect a pleasant future, but they're not hopeful, as we have learned to hope. They have faith, but they're utter strangers to the kind of saving faith which we have to have. They love the truth, but they never experience salvation through the embrace of truth. They were idealists, but they never knew what it was to become an idealist and to experience the thrill of embracing ideals. They're loyal, but they were never really tempted to default. They know nothing about the challenge of loyalty. They're unselfish, but they never became that way through the conquest of selfishness. Sure, they enjoy the sweetness of pleasure, but they know nothing of how pleasant pleasure can be as an escape from pain. On 62. what they're discussing here in comparing Havoners and Finaliters, they're discussing two kinds of maximum finites. And I will find the reference I'm looking for here. It escapes me. Universal algebra, it's 1158. Page 1158. Look down the page at the two italicized paragraph headings. We're discussing finite reality, and they're contrasting primary maximums and secondary maximums. A primary maximum is something like a Havona native, naturally born perfect. A secondary maximum is something like a finaliter, a being who has achieved perfection experientially. And it's interesting to read on. They say that there is a tertiary maximum. I think of those as the creature Trinitized sons. This, I think, is the best discussion in the papers of the difference between a primary and a secondary finite maximum. Further expansion of this concept. Just make a cross reference here to page 360, paragraph 3, the evolutionary idea. This is in the paper on the evolution of local universes, and it discusses the relationship between the beings of perfection and the beings of evolution. The relationship between Havona and the seven superuniverses. Can't they use language, though? You know, you really can't explain a Havona native to us, but you get a feeling for them here, don't you? And, you know, these papers make an appeal to honest self-respect, not to pride and ego. But as I read these paragraphs, I'm glad I'm a man. You know? You recall that the Alpheus twins knew they were the least of the 12 apostles and felt cheerful about it? It's words like this that enable one to accept his imperfections and feel cheerful about them. Not smug or lethargic, but cheerful. I think the last section in the paper on the attributes of God is one of the great pieces of philosophic writing in these papers, as well as a great piece of rhetoric. Read that first paragraph. Against the light of all that we've discussed, with divine selflessness, consummate generosity, the Universal Father relinquishes authority and delegates power, but he is still primal. His hand is on the mighty lever of the circumstances of the universal realms. He has reserved all final decisions and unerringly wields the all-powerful veto scepter of his eternal purpose with unchallengeable authority over the welfare and destiny of the outstretched, whirling, and ever-circling creation. The sovereignty of God is unlimited. It is the fundamental fact of all creation. Over on the next page. Does God suffer? Now you see the Divine Counselor is considering the whole nature of God here. How could God suffer on the top floor of the firehouse? Or maybe even on the second floor? But maybe on the first floor? Maybe on the first floor, God does not choose to know the end from the beginning. Even as the human mind of Jesus during his public ministry sometimes did not choose to know the content of the divine mind of Michael. Sometimes he did, sometimes he did not. The Divine Counselor says he doesn't know, but he thinks he does.
Page 53.
Last paragraph in this paper. They engage in one of the most beautiful descriptions of the deity of the First Source and Center in contrast to the personality of God. This paragraph starts out by discussing broadly the deity of the First Source and Center. It concludes with a portraiture of the personal nature of the First Source and Center. He's power, form, energy, process, pattern, principle, presence, an idealized reality. But he's more. He's personal, exercises a sovereign will, experiences self-consciousness of divinity, executes the mandates of a creative mind, pursues the satisfaction of the realization of an eternal purpose, and manifests a father's love and affection for his universe children. And then they say, if you want to understand that, study the life and teachings of Jesus. In that life and in those teachings, these truths are completely comprehensible and wholly experienced. And then this paper closes with what I guess you folks call it the same as we do. In Chicago, we've learned to call it the benediction. With one little modification, I don't use sons in the plural. I've spoken this in many churches. I've concluded many a talk by reciting this benediction. It's a wonderful piece of rhetoric. It's a beautiful expression of the interaction of the three paradise deities. You know, I think these so-called tough papers up here are real exciting and real, real beautiful. This language is exquisite in spots. And having discussed his attributes, they say, all right, how is he related to the universe? Paper 4 talks about his attitudes, his unchanging character, his relation to nature, and oh, how in that section they dynamite pantheism. Remember when they point out nature is scarred or beautiful face is marred by all the erroneous choices of creatures, as well as exhibiting the beauty of a divine purpose. They say God is not in nature. Nature, yeah, God is in nature, but nature is not God. Elsewhere in the papers they say, when man discovers God in nature, this is proof that that man has first discovered God in his own heart. Having found God, you can observe him in nature, but you never find him there. The discussion of God and nature is really the stand which the Urantia papers make against pantheism. This is not a pantheistic God. I think one of the best illustrations of pantheism is taken from Hindu teachings, and it shows how slippery the human mind can be in rationalizing. Says the pupil to the teacher, "But teacher, if God is everywhere, and if I am God, and God is in the elephant, why did the elephant almost run me down yesterday?" And the teacher replies, "But did you not see God also riding in the form of the elephant driver, warning you to get out of the way?" This is not logic, this is rationalization. God's character simply doesn't change. He's not whimsical. He's not fluctuating. You know, in many ways, this is a discussion of the gospel according to Melchizedek. When this local universe son came down here to lay the foundation for Michael's bestowal, you know, somewhere on earth there had to be a concept of God which was sufficiently decent so that Michael could say, "This is my father," and then proceed to grow it and elaborate on it. I think Melchizedek wisely concentrated on a basic idea. God is dependable. God is moral. God is not whimsical. You make a contract with God, he will keep his end of the bargain. Until you trust God, you can't love him, can you? This, in a sense, is a discussion of the gospel according to Melchizedek, God's unchanging character. When they speak about the realization of God, well, read that first paragraph on page 58 under the caption. God is the only stationary, self-contained, and changeless being in the whole universe of universes, having no outside, no beyond, no past, and no future. You know, they're trying to talk a little bit about the third floor of the firehouse here, aren't they? And when you say this, you're talking about a being you can't understand. And then they contrast this. God's absoluteness, second paragraph, page 59. God's absoluteness pervades all seven levels of universe reality. And the whole of his absolute nature is subject to the relationship of the Creator to his universe creature family. Precision may characterize Trinitarian justice in the universe of universes, but in all his vast family relationships with the creatures of time, the God of universes is governed by divine sentiment. First and last, eternally, the infinite God is a Father. Of all the possible titles by which he might appropriately be known, I have been instructed to portray the God of all creation as the universal Father.
Instructed by whom?
He came from Uversa.
You know, I don't know, but I'll bet these divine counselors had some long discussions with their ascendant associates. I'll bet a cookie that he talked to the mighty messengers attached to this commission. See, a divine counselor operates under the handicap of never having been human. A mighty messenger is an ex-mortal. Let's turn to page 1153. And take a look at the counterpoint of this point. Paragraph 4. Ever remember that man's comprehension of the Universal Father is a personal experience. God, as your spiritual Father, is comprehensible to you and to all other mortals. But your experiential, worshipful concept of the Universal Father must always be less than your philosophic postulate of the infinity of the first source and center, the I Am. Power, principle, presence, process, idealized reality. You can feel what you love. But you know that what you love is much less than all that is there. This is the difference, I think, between the truth of God and the fact of God. And again, over on page 59, third from the last paragraph. We crave the concept of the infinite, but we worship the experience idea of God. Our anywhere and anytime capacity to grasp the personality and divinity factors of our highest concept of deity. We should be challenged by the immensity of God and comforted by our feeling for Him. And then that last paragraph near the bottom of page 59, the consciousness of a victorious human life on earth is born of that creature faith which dares to challenge each recurring episode of existence when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it, a part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And that is the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith. Long before the ascenders reach Avona, they've developed a battle cry, which the papers present as, quote, in liaison with God, nothing, absolutely nothing, is impossible. These papers very seldom teach in a negative manner. But at the conclusion of this paper, section 5, at the bottom of page 59, they take off on the atonement concept. They simply go at it with hand grenades and bombs. they just pronounce it to be blasphemous on the character of God. You know, I always remember this whole sacrificial idea came home to me as a little boy. I got my religious training from my mother. I once could recite all the judges in Israel and so on. And I had a child's book of the Bible. And I always remember the woodcut at the end of one of the chapters. And it showed little Ikey tied down on the rock. And above him was old Abe poised with that wicked-looking knife. And the angel had gotten there in a Buck Rogers photo finish, you know? And the argument I gave my mother was, but suppose the angel had been late? I mean, I was little Ikey, you know? And Abe was my old man. And mother said, but the angel wasn't late. I said, but suppose. And she could never sell me on any idea which would put a little boy in that kind of a jam with his dad, you know?
You didn't buy it.
I didn't buy it. I would have no part of that whatsoever. Thinking men and women are not going to buy the kind of a God who gets mad at men. Yes?
When I had that story told me in a very literal way, I never could associate God doing that to the fathers, asking the slaves.
Isn't that awful? Isn't that awful? As the papers point out, when they get into the discussion of sacrifice, they say the celestial personalities may occasionally have intervened to prevent those things, but they certainly never egged them on. Well, more about that in the evolution of religion. I think paper 5 is the most intimate of the 5 discussions on God. And it should be, because they're talking about God's relation to us. They're talking about the approach to God, His presence. What is true worship? What is His relation to religion? How does one become conscious of God? And then, in the very last section, they introduce this radically new concept of personality as a fourth reality. Not matter, not mind, not spirit, but something yet again. Something which God gives. I like this statement. God provides for the sovereign choice of all true personalities. No personal creature can be coerced into the eternal adventure. The portal of eternity opens only in response to the free will choice of the free will sons of the God of free will. This is first and last a family. What does God get out of this? Love, freely given. And as near as I can see, that's all he wants. In one place, the author of this group of papers says, if it were possible to divest God of all his tremendous powers, I think we would still love him just as much because of what he is. I think you might appropriately note down some cross-references here, if you will. In this section on the God of Personality, cross-reference page 106. Let's take a little time out at this point. We'll skip it. On page 106, they continue a discussion of personality because they are discussing the relationship of the infinite spirit to personality. And if you look at the third from the last paragraph, very interesting. God bestows personality by his personal free will. Why he does so, we can only conjecture. How he does so, we do not know. Neither do we know why the third source bestows non-father personality. But this the infinite spirit does in his own behalf, in creative conjunction with the eternal Son, and in numerous ways unknown to you. The infinite spirit can also act for the Father in the bestowal of first source personality. Let's take a little time out right now and talk about personality, as we're going to talk about matter, mind, spirit, space, time, as we encounter them. There are basically two types of creatures who have free will choice. Type one possesses father personality, and they may get that personality direct from the universal father, or the conjoined actor may give it to them. Look at it this way. Think of personality as being like money in the bank. God signs on the account. He's also made the infinite spirit an attorney in fact. The infinite spirit can sign checks on the Father's checking account and bestow personality for the Father. Yes. For a moment. This kind of personality, which is non-father, what they call in here third source personality. Third source personalities have free will choice, but they are not in the Father's personality circuit. And we know some examples. The power centers are third source personalities, but are not in the Father's personality circuit. I said power centers, not master physical controllers. Some of them are not personal. But all of the power centers have free will. They're highly volitional. The associate power directors have free will. But some of their subordinates on the lower levels of the master physical controllers do not have personality. They are living, intelligent machines. Going back again to page 70, section 6, the God of Personality. There is a second important cross-reference I think you should make. Is this helpful to you? When we hit personality, we'll spend some time on it.
What was your last?
191. To the end of that paper. This is the last half of the paper on the seven master spirits. And it starts with a discussion of cosmic mind. It goes on into a discussion of morals, virtue, and personality. It goes on to a discussion of Urantia personality and concludes with a discussion of the reality of human consciousness. You see, when you try to deal with personality as we know it, you've just almost got to deal with mind at the same time. because our personality functions in the mind arena. And you can best see personality by observing its function. And when it functions, you're dealing with mind, personal mind. It's in this discussion that they point out that personal mind, or that mind, has three inalienable qualities. Quality number one, let me use their language.
Is this still 191?
This is 191 to the end of the paper. Number one is the mathematical response of mind.
Are you reading it?
I'm putting it in my own words. The mathematical response of mind. All human civilizations develop mathematics and produce science of some quality. Number two, the moral or duty response of mind. All civilizations evolve some form of justice. And number three, the worshipful response of mind. All civilizations evolve religions of one kind or another. Civilizations come, civilizations go, cultures rise and fall. But these qualities are expressed in each succeeding civilization because they're basic and constitutive in mind. On page 194, they take inventory of seven functions of human mind because it is personal mind. Here is personality in action in the human mind. These are the functions of the relative free will of a human being. Moral decision, spiritual choice, unselfish love, group loyalty, cosmic insight, the attempt to do God's will, and the pursuit of divine values. This is what mind can do because it's personal mind. And then let's make a third cross-reference on back on page 70. And let's refer to their last full-dress discussion of personality. Page 1225. Paper on personality survival. Second paragraph starts out this way. While it would be presumptuous to attempt the definition of personality, gosh, it's an unsolved mystery of the universe of universes. Let's see who's writing this paper. Kessinger. It may prove helpful to recount some of the things which are known about personality. And then there's a recital of 14